Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's special guest is an immensely popular singer, actress, and author who became an immediate global superstar in 1977 with her mega hit song, You Light Up My Life. The song became one of the greatest multi-platinum singles in pop music history, spending an unprecedented 10 weeks at number one on the Billboard charts and selling over 4 million albums. She received a Grammy Award for Best New Artist, and since then she's received another 7 Grammy nominations and winning 2 more in 1980 for Best Inspirational Performance and 1983 for Best Gospel Performance. She's also won a slew of other awards, including Top New Female Vocalist at the Academy of Country Music Awards, 2 Dove Awards for Best Album, a Music City News Award for Best New Female Artist, and 7 Record World Awards. She's recorded 13 albums, including You Light Up My Life, Love Has No Reason, With My Song, Saving It Up, Surrender, Friends for Life, Home for Christmas, and my 2 personal favorites, Reflections of Rosemary, which is a beautiful tribute to her late mother-in-law, the legendary Rosemary Clooney, and her latest album, Swing This, which has solidified her reputation as one of the best vocal interpreters of the Great American Songbook. Our guest has appeared in dozens of TV shows and starred in 2 of her own TV specials, and she co-starred in one of the most popular TV movies of the 80s, Sins of the Past, co-starring Kirstie Alley, Kim Cattrall, and Anthony Geary. On the stage, she starred on Broadway in Grease as everybody's favorite bad girl, Rizzo. And in 1990, she starred in the highly acclaimed revival of The Sound of Music at Lincoln Center, which earned her a Drama Desk Award nomination. She starred in hugely successful national touring productions of 7 Brides for 7 Brothers and The Sound of Music, which I had the great pleasure of seeing here in Toronto in 1987. She's had starring roles in many regional theater productions, including Meet Me in St. Louis, South Pacific, The King and I, 42nd Street, Into the Woods, and many more great shows. And if that weren't enough, she's also written 6 best-selling children's books, illustrated by her dear husband, Gabriel Ferrer. I'm overjoyed to welcome the incomparable Debbie Boone to our show. Debbie, thank you so much for joining us.
Wow, thank you, Harvey. What an introduction. I'm very happy to be with you.
And I'm so thrilled that you're here. I want to start by paying tribute to your dear father, the legendary Pat Boone. How is he doing?
He's great. He has more energy than I do. He has irons and a bunch of fires. He's writing songs. He's still acting in movies. He's still playing tennis and traveling, and he's really doing well.
Well, we all listen to him on Sirius XM radio, and I hope that he just keeps doing that. It's so entertaining.
I get that compliment so many times from so many people wherever I go. People are really enjoying what he's doing there on the 50s channel.
I know that you and your dad have performed on stage together a number of times, which is always a very special event when that happens. But I'm wondering, would you ever consider doing an album of your dad's songs or a tribute album to your dad like you did with the Rosemary Clooney album?
Of course I would. I kind of feel like the time to do those things are after they're not there to sing their songs anymore. And the difference in recording some of his hit records as opposed to what I did with Rosemary is there are a lot of male lyrics that would have to be changed on some of the standards, which isn't undoable. But, you know, I love his song Friendly Persuasion or April Love, but they're not a female lyric. So you'd really have to work at shifting them.
True, true. Debbie, your voice has tremendous versatility. You're equally comfortable singing pop songs, country songs, contemporary Christian music, gospel, and of course, the Great American Songbook. Who were your musical influences when you were growing up?
I had very eclectic taste. I would say, you know, as a young girl, because I could sing in her range, Karen Carpenter was a huge influence for me. I mean, we weren't that much different in age, but she hit certainly before I started recording on my own. And I just loved everything she sang. I loved Barbara Streisand. I think I accredit my love of Barbara to having really good diction when I sing. And I often get that from people that they love to hear me sing because they can understand every word. And that's something I value when I'm listening to singers. I want to hear the words and understand them. But I, you know, I became fascinated. You did an interview with Melissa Manchester. I loved her very much. Bonnie Raitt, I thought about taking up smoking so I could get that gravel in my voice that she has. You know, Sarah Vaughan, what she could do with the, you know, sort of almost vocal gymnastics was really impressive to me. So I love good singers.
Well, I'm going to be asking you about your Rosemary Clooney album in a few minutes. But while we're on the subject of your musical influences, I can't resist asking you now, what was the most important thing you learned from Rosemary Clooney about singing?
I think the most important thing I learned from Rosemary was to communicate whatever it is that you're really trying to communicate. Quit with the trying to impress people with your voice or your runs or your vocal gymnastics. What she could do in a simple phrase by bringing it from some real place inside of her. And she could just melt your heart in a bar of music. And I watched her do it so many times. And it was a huge influence on the way that I interpret a lyric.
Well, I'm really impressed with the list of vocalists that you mentioned, Karen Carpenter and Sarah Vaughan and Barbara Streisand, because they were all great communicators. And they could convey something essential about the human spirit and our shared experience in life. Is that what you strive to do as a vocalist?
Absolutely. Because, you know, as much as I hate to admit it, I have to admit that the older I get, you know, I've lost some of the agility in my voice. I've certainly lost some range over the years. So for me to be viable and to have people want to listen to me sing, I have to have something to say, and I have to be able to make people feel something. I think I've gotten better at that over the years because I've lived a lot more life. And that's what I learned from Rosemary, is she brought who she was into the songs, and there was nothing show-offy about her. I really appreciate that, and I try to catch myself when I'm trying to do something vocally that I think will be impressive and just go, get back to the words. What are you saying? You know?
I think that's so important, and it comes through loud and clear. A lot of people may not realize that you started singing professionally with your family when you were a young teenager, and you and your sisters, known as the Boones, had two hit records, which were covers of a Supreme song and an ABBA song. How was the decision made for you to launch a solo career?
Well, it was pretty easy. I had had opportunities to do it before I did, but we were recording and singing together, traveling as the Pat Boone Family Show, and I didn't feel like it was the right time. And then my older two sisters got married, and one of them became pregnant, and it was looking more and more like this is not going to be something we do on a regular basis any longer, because lives are changing and you know, people are going their separate ways. So it was a very natural kind of turn of events when Mike Curb, if you know who that is, the president of Warner Curb Records and, you know, Mike Curb Congregation, but big in the recording industry and for many people's careers, including my own. He had wanted me to record things on my own prior to You Light Up My Life, but it was the cassette recording that he brought over to my parents' house of You Light Up My Life, asking if I'd be interested to fly to New York and record it. That was the first step of me taking on a solo career.
Well, since you mentioned You Light Up My Life, you became an overnight sensation in 1977 with that song. I mean, suddenly you were everywhere. And we all fell in love with you because you look as beautiful as the song sounded, if that makes any sense. So my obvious question is, did you know when you were recording that song that it would become an instant classic and that you'd still be singing it 45 years later?
I had no idea, no idea whatsoever. I was just so excited that I had the opportunity to go to New York and go into a recording studio where I'd never been, record my first solo recording. And I thought the song was nice, but you know, it wasn't the kind of song that you hear and go, wow, what a hit record. I don't think anybody except the guy who wrote it felt like it had legs like that. I will tell you that I flew with my mother. Mind you, I was 21 years old, but for some reason, I can't remember now why she thought it was important to come with me. Yeah, I was 21, 20 or 21. And she came, and I'm glad she did, because the man who wrote the song, who's no longer alive, Joe Brooks, was difficult. And it being my first experience on my own, he was very critical. He was very specific about what he wanted and what he didn't want. He was not giving me any freedom to interpret whatsoever. And it was upsetting. It really was a strange and upsetting session. But when we finally got the full final vocal, I could tell that my mother was very enamored. And she even said to me, I just know it, Debbie. I just know this is going to be a hit. And of course, I'm thinking, you're like every other stage mother in the world, thinking their kid has, you know, what it takes. But my mother wasn't like that. I don't think my mother or my father really wanted any of us to go into show business as a full-time career, because they knew all the pitfalls and the pressures of it. So I don't think it was their first choice for any of us, but she had a sense that it was going somewhere. And, you know, I kind of rolled my eyes and thought, yeah, yeah. And nobody was more surprised than I was when it started climbing the charts, and it just kept going up, 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 and one hit number one and stays there for 10 weeks. It was shocking.
Were there musical choices that you were forced to make during the recording that you would not have made of your own volition?
Yes, and nothing that I regret, but it's a very bizarre story how this all happened. There was a studio singer who, again, is no longer with us, named Casey Sizek. And she sang for the actress Dee Dee Khan in the movie, You Light Up My Life. And Casey and Joe Brooks had a falling out, and they couldn't agree on terms for her to have the single recording. And he cut her out. It was the track that she had sung to. He took her voice off and put my voice in there. And he had me sing it note for note, like Casey. So if you listen to the soundtrack from the album, it's Casey's voice, not mine, but it sounds like me. And I don't know if my own mother would have known the difference.
You had a number one hit on the country charts called Are You on the Road to Loving Me Again from your 1980 album, Love Has No Reason. Now, country music is in your blood because, if I'm not mistaken, your maternal grandfather was the legendary Red Foley, correct?
Correct. And not many people know that. And there aren't that many people still living that know that name. So fortunately for me, I sing to people who love the American Songbook, and that's a wide age range. So there are still people out there. When I mention it, you hear a gasp in the audience because they don't know that I'm the granddaughter of Red Foley, but they very fondly remember Red Foley from the Grand Ole Opry.
Well, Red Foley's contribution to country music was enormous because he changed the image from hillbilly music to country music to give it much more widespread appeal. He was a monumental figure in the history of country music, wasn't he?
He really was. He really was. And it is my dream to have a tribute CD or a documentary or both, a concert, and have people that remember him come and do duets and really pay him honor that is due him.
I will be in the front row.
Yay!
Of that concert. Now, in the early 80s, you made a distinct shift from country music to contemporary Christian music with the release of your album, With My Song. What inspired that shift?
Well, it was not an intentional shift in terms of, I didn't mean to become a contemporary Christian artist. What I wanted was to record some music that reflected that very big part of my life, which was my faith. And it was very successful at a time when contemporary Christian music was on the rise. So suddenly I just became known as Debbie Boone, the contemporary Christian singer. Even now on, you know, Apple Music or iTunes, a recording that has nothing to do with contemporary Christian music will be labeled as such, which is sort of frustrating to me. I meant to be able to continue to do what I was doing and add in the Christian music, but it just didn't work out that way. And I really have no regrets. I love all the different twists and turns my career has taken because it's given me so much variety and versatility.
Well, when you look back over your career since the late 70s, was there a specific career plan or a strategy that you were following?
I was so green and didn't have any idea how to strategize a career. So it was not well strategized at all. Nobody warned me that when you have a hit record of the magnitude of You Light Up My Life, which was, you know, had broken all the records and, you know, was bigger than anybody could have imagined, that it was going to be extremely difficult to follow it up because what was ever going to measure up? Nothing. So it was almost like starting over. And that surprised me. And I had very little creative control in the beginning stages. Mike Kerb kind of called the shots and made promises to Joe Brooks, the author of You Light Up My Life, that my next single would be one of his records and that I had to have a certain number of his songs on my album. None of my choices. And I didn't know that I don't know that I could have inserted my choices and, you know, had a real say. I just felt like these are the pros. What do I know about it? You know, I'll just take their lead. And then finally, I was so frustrated by not having the choices that I wanted to make. And I changed producers from Joe Brooks in my second album to Brooks Arthur. And that album is entitled Midstream. And the inside joke is changing Brooks in midstream. That's how we gave that album its title. And I was so delighted to work with somebody like Brooks Arthur, who really got a sense of who I was as a singer. And that was one of the most satisfying working relationships of my life.
I think a lot of us assumed that because you were Pat Boone's daughter, you were getting all of this great career advice and business advice from him. So it's interesting to hear you say that you really had no creative control and you weren't really getting the chance to go in the directions you wanted to musically at that time.
Yeah, I think you're right that most people would have assumed differently. And you don't know what you don't know. I had a manager and we were making decisions the best we could. But again, because of the kind of contract that I was under to Mike Kerb, which happened with my dad, I didn't, you know, have my own lawyer making a single artist contract with Mike Kerb. I was part of the Pat Boone family. So what would surprise a lot of people is I didn't get any royalties from You Light Up My Life until about 10 years ago, because it was considered a cross-collateral contract. And everything that my dad was recording for Warner Kerb and the Boone family was recording was all coming out of my royalties. And their powers that be said I never recouped, which is hard to imagine, but they had a lot bigger guns than I did to try to prove differently. So I have frustration, you know, reiterating a story like that, and yet a lot of gratitude that had Mike Kerb not heard something in my voice and given me that opportunity, I wouldn't have the career that I have and all the things I've been able to do. But it was kind of a rocky start based on some bad business deals.
Very much so. And you present, and I know this about you because we have a very dear mutual friend, Shane Stanley. There's right. Absolutely no bitterness in you. You have an attitude about your destiny, and there's so much gratitude in what you just said that it's actually very uplifting.
Well, thank you. I think that we do better in life when we can look for the things that we're grateful for and let go of the things that we think maybe, you know, it could have been better, or I was entitled to something that I didn't get. That whole negativity drags me down. It doesn't really change the circumstances. It just drags me down. So I haven't always felt this way. I had a lot of frustration in the beginning years of feeling like I didn't have control, and I've done a lot of, who hasn't done a lot of growing up? Let's hope we all grow up and see things differently. But over the years, I just look back and think, I might have made different choices that would have had a better career trajectory, but it could have influenced my personal life, which I'm so grateful for. I have a healthy, happy marriage of 43 years and 4 grown children who are the kind of people I couldn't have even imagined I would get to know now, let alone call my offspring. They inspire me. And I was able to be there and be not always a good mother, not always a perfect mother by a long stretch, but I was there for them and I prioritized my family. And I was able to do that, even though over the years I was raising kids, I was traveling quite a bit and taking them with me and having a lot of pressure to try to be everything to everyone. And, you make some mistakes, but I just look back with such gratitude that we're all okay. We're all thriving. And I feel like I've had a very blessed life.
Very much so. And you've certainly blessed all of us with that voice of yours, which brings me to your Rosemary Clooney album, Reflections of Rosemary. It's just an amazing album. It's one of my all-time favorites because you didn't just sing the song she's most connected with. You gave us a portrait of who she really was from a unique family perspective as her daughter-in-law. I have to mention your version of Blue Skies, which is so beautiful. Is it true that you have an a cappella recording of Rosie singing Blue Skies to your son?
I do. I carry it with me. I play it from my phone in my shows when I talk about Blue Skies, because there's something so touching. She recorded it on a little cassette player while she was on the road, because this was a song she used to sing to my son Jordan, her first grandchild, and it was their song. It was something she sang to get him to go to sleep, something she would sing if he was crying. She'd call him from the road and sing it on the phone to him, and she made a little a cappella cassette recording. You can hear on that recording her slapping her leg for time, and you hear a little glitch in the recording. But he would carry it around on a little play school cassette player to hear Grammy singing Blue Skies whenever he wanted to. And we'd saved, thank God we saved that cassette all those years. And it's the bonus cut on that album.
Oh, it's just magnificent. I have to say to people, if you are not familiar with this album, all of Debbie's albums are amazing. I have them all, but that one in particular is so moving. For example, your selection of songs was really rather unusual. Tell me why you chose the Hank Williams song, I'm So Lonely I Could Cry.
Well, we talked about a lot of the things that we wanted to be able to address in the liner notes and then eventually in concert, because I knew I wanted to do a tribute to Rosemary concert of the songs we were recording. So we chose songs that enabled me to tell stories and things about Rosemary and our relationship that people wouldn't already know. Bette Midler did the covers of her hits and did it as only Bette could have done. And I was glad that was off the table so I could do something much more intimate and personal. Yeah. And one of the things that I wanted to address was that Rosemary and I often talked about the fact that we had country roots in common. She, was from Maysville, Kentucky, and she grew up singing in radio with her sister and did a lot of country music in the beginning years, including a big hit by Hank Williams called Half as Much. I think that was her first big hit record. And I have this picture of Rosemary and my grandfather, Red Foley, standing on the stage of the Grand Ole Opry. She's singing Half as Much, and he's standing behind her in the liner notes. It's very little, but I think we have the picture in the liner notes of the CD. But he's got his cowboy hat on and his arms are crossed and he's looking at her, and you can just see he's delighted with how she's singing and enjoying her. And of course, neither one of them had the opportunity when they were together to know what would be happening down the road and that they would be related by his granddaughter and her son getting married and having grandchildren and being connected in such an interesting way. I've stood on that very circle of wood of the Grand Ole Opry and sung his song, Peace in the Valley. And it's a very moving thing to know that both of them stood there together on that same piece of stage. And I have now done that a couple of times.
I really feel like they are your guardian angels.
I do too.
Do feel that. Now, you
I
know,
do too.
Yeah, it's very strong. Now, as you know, in 1982, there was a TV movie called Rosie, the Rosemary Clooney Story. In fact, last week we had Tony Orlando on the show, who played your father-in-law, Jose Ferrer, in that movie. The movie conveyed the impression that Rosemary Clooney had a very tough and sometimes tragic life and that she was a sad person. But is that how you remember her?
No, I mean, there is definitely truth to that. You know, she really had some extraordinary struggles growing up, but also a lot of joy. And, you know, I think she remembers very fondly being on the road singing with her sister with, I believe, the Tommy Dorsey band. And she just learned so many great things about music in her early career. Then the movie does portray, you know, things going sour in her marriage with Jose. And I think that was one of the biggest heartbreaks of her life. I do think that Jose was the love of her life. And, you know, I have a picture. I love that I have these pictures that reflect these things, but I have a picture at my wedding where I am with Jose and Rosemary's in the background looking at Jose, and you see the love in her eyes. You just see her adoration of that man, even after, you know, he had done some kind of despicable things in their relationship. I came to love Jose and know him, and he, in his latter years, I think, really did a lot of healing in his relationship, certainly with her and with his five kids. So, you know, again, we all go through hard things, but I think Rosemary was probably the kind of communicator that I aspire to be because of, you know, the good and the bad that she encountered.
Do you think she would have been happy with your album?
I do. I do. I'm very proud of it. It was, I used all the musicians that played on for, you know, about 20 years of her Concord recordings when she kind of got that second chance in her career to start doing the American Songbook and hitting the road the way she did. So I was at Capitol Recording Studios in the room where she recorded with the guys that loved her and the A-list musicians. And John Otto, her arranger, became my musical director for many years until just a few years ago when he sadly and shockingly passed away. But we both loved Rosemary. Her manager was very involved, and we wanted it to, as it is called, Reflections of Rosemary, to really be a reflection of who she was as a mother and a grandmother and, you know, those kinds of things, as opposed to just her show business career.
Well, it was very important to me, Debbie, in thinking about this interview, to really highlight some of your albums that mean so much to me and that got much less publicity than You Light Up My Life, because it's always bothered me that you've been pigeonholed in a way into that one hit, when your voice and your song selection in particular is so, so unique and so beautiful. So I hope you don't mind me focusing on these other things.
Not at all. Thank you. I'm delighted. And that's a wonderful compliment. I am so, you know, I recorded some songs under duress that aren't my favorite, you know, that other people made choices, and I did songs that weren't my first choice. I found a way to love every song I've ever sung. And I feel that way about some of the plays and performances that I've done, where you think this isn't really very good, but I have to find a way to love it or I won't bring my best to it. So I've done that, you know, all through my career, no matter what it is that I'm involved in. But the two albums that you mentioned with the American Songbook have felt like home to me, where I just found where my voice really sits right and where I'm able to do the kind of things that I want to do in my communication. Not that I haven't loved, you know, the other music that I've done, but when it's a great arrangement and a great song like is in our American Songbook, I think nothing fits me better than that.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Your recent album, Swing This, it's a perfect example of what you're saying. It contains a terrific collection of classic standards with really great jazz and swing arrangements, very reminiscent of Las Vegas in the 60s. When we were kids, this was the music our parents played. So we grew up listening to those songs. You went on tour to promote that album, Swing This. You must have had a ball singing those songs every night.
I absolutely did. And you know, we've adapted those arrangements. Some of those arrangements, by the way, were from Rosemary's library. She left me all of her arrangements from her, you know, almost 60-year career. And what a legacy for me. So a couple on the Swing This album are Prez Prado, her arrangements of Mac the Knife and Sway. And that's one of my favorite albums of Rosemary's, is called A Touch of Tabasco. If you haven't heard it, you should find it. But it is the most energetic, and it's just so Rosemary, and, you know, a Cuban feel to it. So it's, you know, it's got such a Latin vibe that's, I mean, it's one of the hippest albums out there, I think. So some of those arrangements are there. And when I was in Vegas in the 60s as a young girl, it was the kind of thing I heard coming out of the showrooms, those big horn-driven songs and all that energy and excitement. And I had just, you know, been touring for a couple of years doing Reflections of Rosemary, which was more of a melancholy, bittersweet feel. And I wanted my next music to be fun and feel good. And that's what I was really going for.
Are you able to articulate, Debbie, what it is about the Great American Songbook that appeals to you so much? Why your voice is so perfect for those great classic songs?
I don't know that I can really articulate it, but I will try. I do believe that these songwriters that, you know, are considered to really be the primary writers of the American Songbook were very well educated in music. They understood the music and format. I don't even read a note. So I'm sort of, you know, a Luddite when it comes to understanding what makes a great song. I just know what moves me. And it's a combination of lyric and melody. And the lyrics are so poetic and intelligent. You know, the inner rhymes and the things that you don't hear so much anymore in songwriting today. And, you know, I often will describe a lyric as just feeling good in your mouth, like wrapping your lips around a lyric, a beautiful lyric, especially if it moves you, you know, in your heart. There's nothing more satisfying than that. So I don't know if that made in any sense, but I think it was very skilled musicians and songwriters who wrote from a very intelligent place that make those songs so delicious to sing.
Well, I have my own theory about why your voice is so perfect for those songs. You want to hear it?
I do.
You inherited a lot of talent from your dad. And when he sang those songs in the 50s, he sang them as if they were part of the Great American Songbook, the phrasing, the articulation, the musicality, the melodic way of singing. You inherited that.
Well, I think that's a very astute thing to say. And yes, when I listen to the older music of my dad's, when he started to really sing beautiful songs and not just the sort of, you know, not that they aren't great, his records of things like Ain't That a Shame and Long Tall Sally and some of the cover records that he was doing, Donna Forbid Me, all those things, but the really beautiful things with beautiful arrangements, his voice was absolutely gorgeous and crystal clear, and he could just sail you know, on a melody. And so thank you. Thank you. I hope I got some of that. And between that and kind of studying Rosemary and her phrasing and working with Frank Sinatra and listening to the way he phrased and interpreted, I feel like I've had such great influences.
Oh, and it comes through in your voice, in the way you, the musical choices you make when you sing. Now, as I mentioned in my introduction, I had the great pleasure of seeing you play Maria in The Sound of Music here in Toronto in 1987, but I never got to see you play Anna in The King and I. Was that one of your favorite roles on the stage?
All-time favorite. All-time favorite. I love musical theater, and I've had such a great time doing several shows and a few of them, many different tours of them, like many tours of Sound of Music I did. And I did three different productions of The King and I. And then I did the tour of Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, and then the short stint on Broadway that didn't last. But The King and I is one of my favorite standard Broadway musicals. There's something about it. Some of the shows that I've done have what I would call dead spots. They don't translate over the years as well. So you know, there's still a fun, good show to do, but there are these parts that sort of drag out and you just sort of are like, oh gosh, it's a long way to go to get to the, you know, the end of this show. But The King and I just felt like the minute the overture started, it was like a wave that just picked you up and carried you perfectly to the end. I didn't ever feel like I was working when I did that show. I just felt like I was part of this beautiful story that just took off, and I got to be a part of this slice of life in this woman's, you know, world. And it was so satisfying. It was fun. It was emotional. It was heartbreaking and beautiful. And I just am so grateful that I got to play that role. And I was pretty darn good at that accent. I studied with a dialect coach, and I think I was a pretty believable Miss Anna.
Well, I think I know why you love that show so much. I think it's because both Anna and the King learn, they grow, and they evolve.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that strikes me as the kind of person you resonate with.
You're absolutely right. Another very astute thing for you to say, but that is so true. And it's who I aspire to be. I think people sometimes as they get older kind of get stuck and set in their ways. And I'm determined not to be someone like that. I want to be teachable and continually growing. And in fact, you know, we mentioned earlier, I am a person of faith, and it is a regular prayer every day that God would show me where I'm wrong and where there are things I think I know that may not be the truth and stand in the way of me seeing the things that I do want to know and understand so that I can keep growing and becoming who I am created to be. And in turn, then be able to, you know, share that with other people. You know, when you get set in your ways and you think you know a lot, it ends up dividing you from people instead of connecting you. And I always want to be a person who can connect and not divide.
Boy, does that ever come through loud and clear. And what a refreshing perspective on life. You know, since we're talking about your career in musical theater, of course, it's incredibly impressive on a number of levels that you've had such a tremendously successful career in musical theater. But to me, what really makes you a real standout is that you have an alto voice. You don't have the typical soprano voice that most female leading roles require, and yet you can sing almost anything. Debbie, do you get how incredibly special your voice is?
I don't always feel like that, you know. I think people value the high notes so much that I've never had, that I've always, you know, I've studied over the years and tried to increase my range. I love my lower register, don't get me wrong. I love singing in a low register, but I feel like people are always looking for the ones that have the high notes. It's not necessarily what I gravitate to. I'm not a big fan of, I mean, I'm impressed by people who have high notes and can do kind of gymnastic runs. I'm not one of those people. But the people that I want to hear the people that I want to listen to have a tone, like a rich tone that almost vibrates in your body. You know, I mean, Rosemary was one of those people. By the end, she probably had an octave of a range, you know, having smoked, you know, too many cigarettes and had a little too much to drink over the years. Her voice really, you know, became, the range became much smaller. But what she could do with just, you know, she used to make these cassette recordings at Christmas time as her Christmas card. She'd pick a Christmas song, go into the studio, record it, and over the instrumental, she would speak Christmas messages to everyone on her Christmas list. And people just were so delighted to be on her Christmas list and look for that cassette to show up in the mail and hear her sing, "Have yourself a merry little Christmas." And you'd hear this rich life lived in those words and a warmth that I talk about it like it's brandy, that just you feel the heat of it, the warmth of it in your chest when you listen to her sing just a little phrase, you know. So I know that that's what I aspire to, is to be able to do the same thing that she was able to do.
You're doing it. Believe me. Now, you've written 6 wonderful children's books, including Bedtime Hugs for Little Ones, Tomorrow is a Brand New Day, Counting Blessings, and in my opinion, the sweetest one of all, The Snow Angel. Where do your stories come from?
Well, that actually, Snow Angel was kind of a one-off of all of our books, because basically Gabri and I wrote our books from our lives as parents and what was really happening in our home with our own kids. The illustrations were all taken from photographs of our kids in real life. And then he would make an illustration from that. And we would write stories about conversations that we'd had with our own kids or remembered having as kids ourselves. But The Snow Angel was more of a created fairy tale, but it was based on our love and our kids' love and every kid's love of, you know, falling down into the snow and making a snow angel. I mean, what kid doesn't love the opportunity to fall back into fresh, clean snow and make a snow angel? So when it came to us that this snow angel would come to life and that would be part of this tale that we were going to tell, it just became a delightful project for both Gabri and myself to work on and figure out what's going to happen now that we know this snow angel is going to come to life. What's going to happen? And, you know, it took us some time to figure it all out, but I never would even think about writing a children's book without Gabri illustrating it. I think the magic is in our working together and the charm that he brings as an illustrator.
Oh, absolutely. They're beautiful books. There was an audio edition of The Snow Angel that featured some original songs, and you released a video series entitled Debbie Boone's Hug-Along Songs, but I don't think you've ever recorded an entire children's album, have you?
No, I haven't, and that seems like a shame, doesn't it? We did all the recordings from the volume 1 and 2 of the Hug-Along Songs, so music enough for an album exists, but I never really did a children's album. And, you know, maybe it's something to consider. I know that Gabri and I have both considered, now that we're grandparents, because once our kids kind of outgrew children's books, we outgrew making them because we didn't have that lived experience any longer. But now we have these 4 fantastic grandkids, and I'm thinking maybe now is the time to do another book from a grandparent perspective. And maybe now is the time to do a children's music album.
Well, do you mind if I give you an idea for another album? I'm really hoping you do.
I do not mind at all.
I did mention the tribute album to your dad, but Because You Light Up My Life was the theme song for a movie, I think you have the perfect voice to do an entire album of movie theme songs like Windmills of Your Mind, Moon River, Evergreen, The Rose, The Way We Were, the theme from Arthur. I could go on and on. What do you think?
I love the idea. And my manager and I have discussed that being a good way to go. We made lists before of movie theme songs. I did a show with a symphony here in Thousand Oaks near where I live called Stage and Screen. And it was all music from movies or theater productions, but a completely soloed out just movie theme songs is a really good idea. And I'd have to figure out now without record companies that have the dough to put together, because movie theme songs need the orchestration, you know. I think that's what we all kind of are moved by, is the beautiful string lines and the big production of a movie theme song. So I'd have to figure out how to get something like that done in the way that it should be done.
Crowdfunding.
Well, I know that people are doing that. I find that, you know, I don't think anybody does that easily. Asking for money is not my strong suit. But
well, you know how I see it, Debbie? Your fans got to listen to you on the radio for free all those years. So when people want to contribute to a project because they believe in the project and they believe in you, it's a way of thanking you for all the joy and entertainment you've brought us.
Well, I like that perspective, and I will definitely take it to heart and think about it. But I do really love the idea of doing movie theme songs. There are so many beautiful movie theme songs that have meant a lot in my life and been favorites of mine. So it would be easy to get an album worth of songs that I can personally connect with and feel like I have something to bring to them.
Well, of course, I have my own agenda because I want to get you back on the show to promote the album when it comes out.
Ha ha! Well, that's a done deal. If this album happens, that's a done deal.
Oh, thank you, Debbie. I want to tell our viewers that you can learn more about Debbie Boone, buy her music, and see her concert schedule by going to her official website, debbieboone.com. You can also follow her on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Well, Debbie, in our remaining moments, I have to give a shout out to our mutual dear friend, the brilliant Shane Stanley, who facilitated this interview. He's such a wonderful guy, isn't he?
He's a lovely guy and sort of a new friend for me, but I've just been very impressed by him. I went to a premiere of one of his movies recently in Palm Springs, and hopefully we're going to be working together on another project in the near future. So he's very accomplished and just a delightful guy all the way around.
He sure is. He's the real deal. And thank you, Shane, so much for connecting me with Debbie.
Yes, well, Debbie, thank you, Shane.
Debbie, you've had an amazing career over 4 decades as a singer, recording artist, actress, musical theater performer, concert artist, author. The obvious question at this point is, do you have any plans to sit down and write a memoir?
I don't. I don't have any plans for that. You know, I did an autobiography when I was 21 years old, which is kind of ridiculous when you think about it. But I was under a lot of pressure. Publishing, you know, publishers were coming to me out of the woodwork wanting an autobiography. And I'm 21 years old. What do I have to say? And finally, a publisher came to me, a little publishing house called Thomas Nelson, who does a lot of Christian publishing, came to me saying, there are a lot of people who want to know who you are now, who you are right now, and what is the story of how you got to who you are now. And it made sense. And then they hired somebody to work with me, kind of a ghostwriter. And it was not my voice. And I had to say, this doesn't feel right to me. And then I wrote on my own, in my own voice, but with a guy who helped me edit and put it together. And I have to tell you, I want to go find every single one of them and burn them, because you're so naive and you think you know so much more at 21 than you do. And I find it embarrassing now that book is out there and it has me saying, you know, things that I no longer believe or agree with. I named it Debbie Boone So Far. So it was who I was at 21 years old. And now, of course, with a lot of life under the bridge and, you know, much more to say, and also kind of this new me that isn't so sure she knows everything. You know, I it makes me uncomfortable to think about it. But I must say, I have been a journaler all of these years. I have journals, boxes and boxes of journals. So it might not be an autobiography in the sense that I think my life is so interesting, I should let people know about it. But maybe, you know, going back and finding out where I've struggled and what I've learned over the years, maybe there's something eventually that I would come to, but I don't have any plans for it.
Well, I'll tell you why I hope you do write a memoir. Your career has had not only great success and longevity, but you've demonstrated enormous stability and maturity in an industry that's not known for that. You come from a beautiful family. You raised a beautiful family. And I think people are interested in knowing how you navigated your success in such a centered and grounded and humble way. So that's why I hope you do it.
Well, I will take that to heart. And, you know, I just have a firm belief that when things are supposed to happen, everything sort of converges to let you know the time is now and the time is right to do that. So I'm not saying yes or no. I'm just staying open.
Good. It's also another reason to get you back on the show to promote the book.
You know, you're very wily.
Well, Debbie, it's been such a pleasure having this opportunity to have you on our show. I know your concert schedule is very demanding. I'm immensely grateful to you for taking the time to grant me this interview. Thank you so much, Debbie.
Thank you. What a pleasure. What a pleasure. And thank you for taking the time to really do your research so that we could have a great conversation like this.
It was a pleasure. Our guest has been the one and only Debbie Boone. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you to our producer, Steve Silver, my wonderful managers, Rick and Robin at the Marcelli Company in Hollywood, my entire team at XPTV1 in the UK. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.